is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Bob Walsh from Providence College, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today. Hey, Hoopheads. We all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E, and use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's A-R-Y-S-E.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off.
The relationships you have with your players are vital. And those kids need to feel like I'm playing for somebody, I'm being recruited by somebody who truly cares about me and who truly loves me. In all my stops along the way, I can honestly tell you, the people who have done that the best have had the best outcomes.
Stan Johnson is the men's head basketball coach at Loyola Marymount University, taking over the program on March 20th, 2020. Prior to his arrival at LMU, Johnson coached 5 seasons at Marquette University and was promoted to associate head coach in June of 2017 after helping guide the Golden Eagles to an NCAA tournament trip in the 2016-2017 season. Johnson arrived in Milwaukee after working the previous 2 seasons at Arizona State. Johnson also spent time as an assistant at Drake University, the University of Utah, Cal State Northridge, Southwest Baptist University, and Bemidji State University. As a player, Johnson was a 3-year letterman at Southern Utah University. He was a team captain and starter in the 2000-2001 season and helped lead the Thunderbirds to the Mid-Continent Conference title and a berth in the NCAA tournament. Johnson played his senior year of college basketball at Bemidji State before beginning his coaching career by joining the Bemidji coaching staff the following season. Don't miss our free Hoopheads Pod webinar series on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. If you miss a live webinar, you can buy lifetime access to any of our previous webinars for $4.99 on the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavaliers Central, Grizz and Grind, Knuck If You Buck, and the 305 Culture Miami Heat podcast. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Shoot an email to info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Make sure you have your notebook ready. You'll definitely want to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Stan Johnson, head men's basketball coach at Loyola Marymount University. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel, and tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast the head coach at Loyola Marymount University, Stan Johnson. Stan, welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. Pleasure to be on here with you today.
We're very excited to have you on, get a chance to dig into all the things that you've been able to do in the game across many levels, both as a player and as a coach. I want to start by going back in time to when you were a kid, and you've got kind of a unique story for someone who ends up a Division I college basketball coach, growing up in West Africa. Talk to us a little bit about your childhood, what it was like growing up there, and then how eventually your family made your way to the United States and you got introduced to the game of basketball.
Yeah. You know, I have a, you know, an interesting childhood, you know, probably compared to the normal person who's just born in America. But, you know, I was born in Liberia, West Africa, is where my dad's from. My dad went to Montana Tech for college. He met my mom there. They moved back to Liberia and, you know, started a family there. I was, you know, there till I was 10 years old. My sister was born there. My brother was born there, both who are younger than I am. But when I was 10, there was a civil war that broke out in the country. And it's, you know, really knocked that country back for what looks to be decades upon decades upon decades. And till this day, it really hasn't recovered. But, you know, we were very fortunate. My mom was an American citizen. So at that point, we had dual citizenship and we were able to be evacuated out of the country. You know, my dad had just, you know, built a second home and, you know, a dream house and, you know, life was pretty good for them, but we lost it all, moved to the States with about three bags and, you know, kind of settled in Salt Lake City, Utah.
How quickly after the Civil War broke out, were you able to get out? How quick was that process or how slow was that process in your memory?
It was probably, you know, probably 3 weeks to a month between the war really affecting us and when we got on that Army warplane and got out. You know, so it was probably 3 weeks to a month that we, you know, you got to experience war. I mean, you know, every night you heard, you know, gunfire up close, you know, over the house, you know, things of that nature. You experience rebel leaders and or members coming to your door, knocking on your door. And I remember every time they would knock, my parents would make us hide, you know, so they would knock on the door. You would hear that knock. You knew it was them and they would have us hide under beds. And we had other family members staying with us because we all wanted to be together. And every, you know, in all those moments, man, you never know at what point they were going to maybe come in your house and shoot everybody up or kill you, kidnap somebody. But, you know, they would ask for the car. Give us your car key. Give us what you have in the pantry, give us money, you know, and, you know, we were fortunate. Those are the things that they took and, they didn't take our lives.
Yeah. I'm imagining as a 10-year-old kid, and it sounds like prior to that breaking out that you guys had a pretty stable lifestyle and there was nothing that kind of indicated to you that you were going to have to experience that. So I'm sure as a 10-year-old kid, having to hide under the bed every time somebody comes to the door was not the experience that, you know, really was something that you thought was ever going to happen to you. So when you were thinking about when you guys got here to the United States and you think about your athletic background, what were some of the things that you played while you were in West Africa? Were you, had you been introduced to basketball at all, or you were just playing, what were you playing back then? And then how did that transfer into playing basketball when you got to the United States?
Yeah, you know, basketball at that time in Africa, the game wasn't, I wouldn't say, you know, in 1990, it wasn't a global game at that point. You know, the game was trending that way. Basketball was maybe the third or fourth sport, you know, in that country. You know, so I had touched the ball a little bit, but, you know, had no real interest in basketball. You know, soccer dominated the continent, not just in Liberia, but the entire continent of Africa. The community where we were in, it was really mixed. A lot of foreigners, a lot of Germans because of the mining community. So tennis was a big sport there. And I, you know, at that age, was playing soccer and tennis. So those were the games I kind of gravitated to. And, you know, at the age of 10 that I was, you know, actually playing.
Are you still a tennis player today?
You know what? I love the game. I haven't touched a racket in a long time, but I, you know, I still love it. I was just watching the U.S. Open over the weekend. You know, it's a great game, but I wouldn't consider myself a tennis player by any stretch of the imagination.
Just don't get disqualified hitting a person with the ball on the throat, right?
Yeah, that was incredible. You know, I when I was watching the highlights, I never got the real angle. So it looked like he hit it, and I thought the ball bounced. So I was going, man, that didn't look that bad, right? But then I finally got to see the hit, and it was he got her pretty good.
Yeah, you just wonder what's going through his head in that moment. Like, what are you doing at that point? It's just you know, it's crazy. But then again, I guess I grew up with John McEnroe as my favorite tennis player, so I don't really have room to probably say a whole lot about that.
Exactly.
A little bit of a different era of tennis back then, for sure. The decorum was a little bit different at that point. All right, yeah. So hoops. So how do you get introduced to hoops? What's the first? Give us the story of your first indoctrination into the game.
Well, you know, we got to Salt Lake City. You know, finally got settled in. You know, as always, you know, going to school. You know, as a new kid, and I'm thinking about my little kid right now. I have three kids, but my 5-year old, he finally went to. His school started yesterday, and you know, he was born in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and you could see the angst he had going to school, right? It's always hard, but I think it's even harder when you're coming from a totally different continent and something that looks polar opposite to this new way of life that we had. And, you know, so you go to school and, you know, that's already an anxiety in itself. You know, at that time in 1990, I mean, there weren't a lot of African-American guys running around Salt Lake City, you know, so I'm probably one of maybe 3, 4, 5, maybe in the entire school. And one of the other guys is, you know, my brother, who's a couple years younger than me. So there's not many.
Right.
So that's a whole nother ball of wax. And then, you know, you know, so it's like, who do I hang out with at recess? And so these guys are getting ready to play a game. They asked me to play, and they didn't ask me if I could play. They just assumed I could. And I'll never forget, I was literally the first pick. They picked me first because, again, you're black, man. You got to be able to hoop.
Right.
You know, black guys can hoop. And I always kid around. I mean, you know, I didn't know if it was a soccer ball or basketball. You know, do you bounce it or kick it, right? And I probably kicked the ball off my feet more than I bounced it. And that was the last time I was picked first. I was picked last that entire year. What made it even more disappointing is when they knew you were the last guy and that team had you. So there's two guys standing and one team picks the other. They're like, oh God.
Oh no. Yep.
We have him, you know? So I had that for a year. You know, I just decided I wasn't going to have that anymore. And I was going to, you know, really dedicate myself to the game, fall in love with the game. I was fortunate. Our condominium where we lived was literally across the street from the elementary. So I'd walk over there every day by myself and work on my game. And I couldn't wait for that next recess, you know, the beginning of the next school year. And, you know, the tables turned quickly.
What was it about the game? Was it the challenge of it? Was there some particular aspect of it that you liked about it? Was it that you could practice it on your own and get better? What was it about basketball other than that experience of not wanting to be picked last and wanting to improve so you could play in those games? What was it about the game itself that really drew you in?
Well, I think initially, right, it was a way to connect. It was a way to not really be an outcast. It was a way for me to be accepted. It was a way to connect some kid from, you know, like Liberia, West Africa, with another kid from Murray, Utah. And in order to have something you could relate to, that had to be that common bond. You know, so that's what really forced me every day to want to grow, want to get better. And to your point, you know, it was a game that I could literally bounce my ball, go to the hoop, school and work alone. I didn't need somebody to be by my side. And then, you know, I think if you're a competitor and you have that in you, you know, you don't want to get picked last either. So all those three things, you know, working together, really made me fall in love with the game. And I say it all the time. There's what I found from that experience is there's real power in the ball. There's absolute power in the ball. And that ball can unite a lot of people. And it can bring people together. And I've seen that with my own life. I saw that as a kid in elementary. I saw as I got better, the relationships that were established because of the game as I went to college and got into coaching. I always tell people everything I have in my life is because of that round orange ball. And there's power behind it. You know, so those are the things that really, you know, drew me to the game. And those are the things now that I carry with me as I coach.
I don't think there's any doubt about that in terms of the power of the ball. And I would phrase it in almost the exact same way in terms of what I've been able to do in my life and how much I attribute that to basketball, either from the things that I've developed as a person because of what I've learned through the game and then through the relationships and the people that I've gotten to know through a playing career, a coaching career, and then through this podcast. It's really incredible what the basketball can do and how it can, as you said, connect people. When you think back to that time when you're starting to get into the game, you're really starting to work at it, and you're starting to get better, at what point did you start to realize, hey, I'm not just good enough to play at the recess game in elementary school, but as you're moving into junior high and high school, when do you start to realize that, hey, I'm actually pretty good and maybe I'd have an opportunity to play in high school, beyond high school? When did that realization start to hit for you?
I think it got real, probably as a ninth grader. You know, I could feel that my skill set at that point was, you know, a level above the guys I was competing with in junior high. You know, in Utah, junior high is 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. High school there starts 10th, 11th, and 12th. But I felt like, I could sense it. When I went out and played in different AAU tournaments, I felt like I was one of the better players. And then, you know, you start playing with older guys and you're holding your own a little bit. You know, that's when I started getting a sense of, you know, this is something, you know, I have a chance to do in college. And that, you know, just once you get that, there's an even greater drive to continue to get better. And that was, again, a driving force, you know. But for me, you know, I look at kids now and the kids now are so fortunate. There's so many good trainers and so many, they have so many great people around them that know basketball, can help them get better, you know. For me, it was a little different. You know, I feel like everything that I knew, I gave to myself. And I don't mean that in a braggadocious way. I'm actually, you know, some days when I wake up, I'm a little disappointed in that because, you know, had I had a guy around me that really knew the game and understood it and could really teach it to me and help me that way, you know, I may have had a chance to be a better player because I did have the drive, you know. So I was just self-taught that way. And like anything, man, you can only go so far when you're doing it by yourself.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So what did training look like for you during those junior high, high school years? How were you going about trying to get better? Where were you getting your ideas for things you had to work on? And how much were you in the gym by yourself working on your game versus trying to find pickup games or playing on the AAU circuit? Just maybe give us an idea of what your summer looked like when you were in high school.
Well, when I was in high school, you know, it was a little different than when I was in junior high. I would say, you know, even my ninth grade year, I mean, most of my development was right on my front driveway. You know, I spent hours out there. And, you know, when I got into high school, you know, even ninth grade, I just started watching games. You know, being in Utah, you know, you'd watch a lot of obviously Jazz games and you know, the national games that came on TV. I just studied guys, and, you know, you go outside and you try to emulate that. You know, that's kind of how I got better. You know, we'd play a lot of pickup at Taylorsville High School. I was good enough to the point, even as a 10th grader, they would invite me to go play with the varsity team and play up. That helped me. And then, you know, I had a membership to a place called the Sports Mall as a 10th grader that my parents gave me. And on Monday nights, that's where all the good players would show up, you know, within the city and go play. And, you know, it was one of those places where if you lost, you were out, you know, for a while. Just take your ball and go home. You know, it's going to be a minute. But that's where, you know, I really not only continue to grow, but learn how to compete and be competitive, play against older people and really push yourself. So that was kind of my development, how we got better. In terms of AAU, you know, at that point, AAU was active. It was big, but it wasn't what it is today. And I didn't play on a, you know, a high power AAU team. You know, we would go to Vegas and do some of that. But that wasn't a huge piece of my basketball experience back then.
I love what you said about finding the place where all the good players would show up on Monday night. And I think that kind of is similar to the way that I grew up, where you just kind of drive around. You knew that this playground or this park or this gym, this was the night where the best players showed up at that particular location, and you'd figure out a way to get there, hitch a ride with somebody, or as you got older, take your own car or whatever you had to do to go and find those games. And I think that, you know, you talked earlier about the benefits that kids today have of being with trainers and having, I think, a lot better coaching in most cases. Certainly you have a lot more people that are knowledgeable about the game that have an opportunity to impact kids at a younger age, without a doubt. But I do think that one of the things that those kids miss out on, and you've mentioned it a couple times now, is the opportunity to play against older kids when you're younger. And I think there's such a benefit to that, in that you learn how to not only play and use your body and fight off a guy who's bigger and stronger than you, but you also learn some things just about your character and being willing to stand up for yourself as a 14-year-old when you're playing with high school varsity guys or college guys or adults. And that's one of the things that, when I look at the basketball system today, it's one of the things that I feel more bad than anything else, that a lot of kids don't get to experience that same thing that you and I got to experience growing up, playing more pickup basketball with people of all different ages.
Right. You know, I always say too much of any one thing is not good. I'm a big believer in balance. You know, are oranges good for you to eat? Absolutely. If that's all you eat, it's not a good thing. You know, you have to have balance, and, you know, having a great trainer is good. If all you do is train and you don't go and compete and put that training to work, it's not good. Vice versa. If all you do is go out and you're just playing in pickup games and playing, you know, pickup games, but you're not honing your craft on the side, that's not good either. And to your point, I think that's what we miss now. And for me, I thought that's what I missed. You know, I didn't have that real individualized, you know, plan where somebody knew my game in and out and was really even pushing me harder and finding ways for me to get better. You know, I went and I sought that on the court, which was outstanding. You know, but if you could marriage those two things and put those together, gosh, you know, there's power in that. And to your point, I think a lot of kids miss that now. And I think if I look back, you know, I think what we missed on was having people that could lock in on our games and really help us perfect our craft.
Yeah, I agree. I've said it a couple times on the podcast here that from the time I was probably a junior in high school through my entire college career, I basically had two skill development workouts, if you want to call them that. I had one that I would do when I was by myself, and it was always exactly the same. And then I had one that I would do if I had somebody that I could wrangle up that wanted to shoot with me or do whatever. And those are the only two workouts that I did. And there was probably, you know, each one was an hour and a half or whatever it was. But it was the same. It was the same drills every single time. There was no variance. Right. There was no anything. It was just, well, I think this is working for me. I feel like I'm getting better at, you know, these particular things. But you look back on it now and you see the variety that of drills and just skill levels that kids are exposed to. And then you think about the trainers that are watching film and breaking down not only your own individual game of the kids they're working with, but they're looking at pro players and college players and their footwork and the things that they do and how they work, and then transferring that over to the kids that they work with. And I can only imagine a kid like yourself who loved the game and wanted to get better. You know, it's almost like you'd be sitting down at an all-you-can-eat buffet and just being like, you know, give me some more of that, because you just would have eaten all that up and taken it and continued to improve, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things, right? It's something I talk to our guys about all the time. You know, I tell them, you know, I don't know what it's like. You guys don't know what it's like to be 40 like me, but I know what it's like to be 20 or 18 or 17. And if I could go back and be you, knowing what I've known now through my own experience, you know, this is what I would tell you, you know, and this is the balance you have to have within your game. And this is how you have to attack it. Because I look back now and, you know, I'm sure as you do, you go, gosh, if I only knew then what I knew now, if I only had this. But the goal now is to pay that forward. And make sure the people that we encounter in our lives don't have those same experiences, and we can help them have what we didn't have.
Absolutely. So let's think about coaching and when coaching starts to get on your radar. You obviously have a chance to go and play college basketball first at Southern Utah. At what point during your college career do you think about coaching being something that you might want to get into?
Yeah. Well, I was like every other kid. You couldn't tell me I wasn't going to play in the NBA.
There you go. Yep.
You could not tell me. Even, well, you're going to Southern Utah. They never had an NBA player. I'm going to be the first. You know, like, you couldn't tell me. But, you know, I was very fortunate because I began to see there's some guys that are freaking good, man. There are some guys that got some stuff you don't have. And to make it at that level is really, really hard. And guess what? There's some dudes just better than you. And at some point, that hit me. That doesn't mean you can't compete. That doesn't mean you can't, you know, maybe have a living doing this. But it's not going to be what you want. And I think that really hit me, you know, after my sophomore year in high school, in college. You know, you just started to see what greatness looked like, what an NBA guy looked like, what a pro looked like, how they moved, how they thought, how different they were. And I, you know, I said to myself, I'm gonna give it the best shot I can, but I know that this is a game I want to be involved with forever. You know, even in college and high school, my buddies called me coach, right? They used to say, you have such an old soul. It was just something that was in my blood. I mean, I never wanted to take my hand out of the huddle. And I go back to what I said to you when we begin this podcast. For my life, I saw what basketball did for me. I saw the power of the ball. I saw when it's used correctly, man, what life-changing impact it could have on someone. And I wanted to give that back because the game had given me a lot, you know, more than I, you know, deserve. So I felt like coaching and being in the game was my way to repay it and help kids have even a greater experience than I did, you know, as a player. So that's kind of how that started to unfold in my brain.
And did you think, when you started thinking about coaching, was there a level that you had in mind? Did you think, oh, maybe I want to be a teacher and a high school coach? Did you always think college coaching was where you wanted to end up? Did you think, hey, maybe I can somehow work my way up and be a pro coach? Or was it just, I just want to stay involved with this game at whatever level the opportunity presents itself?
Yeah, you know, initially in my mind, I was like, well, you know, maybe I'll go back to my high school and you know, coach high school basketball, be a coach. And then I started at Southern Utah. I started hosting almost everybody. I mean, if a kid came on a visit to Southern Utah.
You were the guy, huh?
I was the guy, right? And I started to find real joy in that. And I love doing that, actually. And I used to kid with my coaches. I used to say, yeah, you guys want me to host this kid and he plays my position, right? But to me, it didn't matter. You know, I wanted to win. There was a challenge in that. I loved, you know, when a kid committed, I felt like, you know what? I had a big part in that, you know, so, and I really found joy in that. And as I started doing that, the more I knew I wanted to be involved in college. You know, I loved that aspect of it, you know, the recruiting piece. But I didn't know, you know, I didn't know where that would start. These jobs are hard, man. Getting a GA position is hard. Getting an assistant coaching position is hard. I mean, they're all hard. But, you know, it was that moment when as I began really hosting kids and selling them on Southern Utah that I knew, you know what, this is something I want to do as a college coach.
If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best. We'll help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com. to get started. All right, so you left Southern University as a player, and you finished up at, I'm going to make sure I pronounce it right, Bemidji. All right, I was right. All right, I was good.
B-E-M-I-D-J-I.
Nice, there you go. See, you still got it. You still got it in you. All right, so you end up there, and then you finish out your playing career, and then you get an opportunity to join that staff. So this is a two-part question. Talk a little bit about, first of all, how that opportunity comes to pass, why there was an opening on the staff, how you ended up with that position. And then two, you go from being a player, and I always find this to be kind of a fascinating thing, where you go from being a player in a program, and then you get to step behind the coaching curtain and kind of see what goes on behind the scenes that maybe as a player, you didn't necessarily know or appreciate all the things that coaching staff was doing behind the scenes that you as a player couldn't see. So talk about how you got the opportunity, and then what were some things that when the curtain got pulled back that were kind of surprising to you when you got the job, or maybe they weren't surprising because you had kind of had your eye on being a coach at that point.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was at Southern Utah for 4 years. I believe my third year there, we went to the NCAA tournament, which to this day, I'm so proud of, one of the greatest accomplishments of my life. But we had a guy that came in by the name of Jeff Gio as an assistant for a year, and he was an enormous difference maker for us. I mean, the way he thought, the way he dealt with players, he really helped us become a tournament team. After that year, he left and got the head coaching job at Bemidji. I had a severe case of tendonitis after that year that we went to the tournament. And, you know, I could feel that, you know, hey, we've done all we could here. I'm almost done. I'm going to graduate. I'm going to have 1 year. And I was talking to him, and, you know, I just felt like, first of all, my knees were giving out. Wasn't that great. Let me think about long-term picture here. So, you know, he said, hey, why don't you come out here, play for a year, finish your career here, and when you're done, we can talk about this coaching thing. And that's what I did. And I went out, played for a year, had a great senior season. Actually, knees never felt as good. I don't know what happened. Maybe it was the ice, the frozen tundra of Bemidji.
Your knees were getting iced every day, right?
Getting iced every day, whether you liked it or not. And then he hired me. And I have to tell you, there wasn't anything that I was really surprised about. You know, it was such a natural fit for me. But that experience, man, has been one that I have so much value in and I hold dear to me. You know, I tell people all the time, even young coaches, you know, you have to make the big time where you are. And the big time is not a place, it's who you are. And I was so thankful, so grateful to be a coach. You know, you're making 10 grand a year. I'm sleeping in the coach's basement. You know, you drive the bus, you sweep the floors, you prepare the practice plans, you watch film, You know, you name it, you do it. And it gave me an understanding of, number one, how hard jobs are. Two, it allowed me to grow in every facet of a coach. And three, it helped me understand that even with less, you can still do more. And that's what we did. And because of that experience, I've taken that with me in every job. And because of the Bemidji experience, really, it's allowed me to appreciate every step in my journey. You know, so I love living there. I tell people all the time, you couldn't tell me when I put that Bemidji polo on if I was working at Duke or if I was working at Bemidji. That's the sense of pride we had. And, you know, with that came a lot of success there.
I think what I always use the phrase, it's the glamorous life of a college basketball coach, when you hear the story that you just described of somebody getting their first start in the job and maybe they're getting paid nothing or they're getting paid a couple thousand dollars and they're sleeping in someone's basement and they're sweeping the floor and they're driving the bus and they're doing every little thing. And I've talked to so many coaches on the college level who have started the same way that you started. And to a person, they all say that those first couple of years where they're maybe at a smaller school, they're at a lower level, they're on a staff that maybe has one or two others, maybe only one full-time person and a couple part-timers, but you learn to do so many different things that translate as you move on in your career that you can always look back on those experiences and say, yeah, I remember when I had to do that. And I remember when I had to learn how to do this. And by doing that, you can pass that information then along to the other people who eventually are part of your staff as you move on in your career. But you can also kind of ground yourself and just say, hey, I remember when I had to first learn how to do this. And now maybe I'm doing it at a higher level, but I'm still doing the same things. And I think your line of make the big time wherever you are, for any young coach out there, to me, that's a key phrase that you should tape to your mirror every single day. And just remember that if you're treating your job like it's the big time, then you probably will eventually have an opportunity to move on to a higher level or a bigger job. Because if you're doing a great job where you are, that's how opportunities open themselves up to you, is by the effort that you put in the job that you're in currently. If you're looking out the door all the time for the next opportunity, that next opportunity is going to be a lot harder to come by, I would guess.
Yeah. You know, and the other thing for me, it makes you more relatable. You know, like right now, if I had a staff, I have two young GAs, I laugh at them, you know, because, you know, you got to do a lot of grunt work. I don't treat them like GAs. They have a voice, they have an opinion, value it, but they have to do things that are hard. They have to do things that, you know, are not glamorous. And one of them just got done playing. And I can relate to that. And I think sometimes when you haven't gone through that, you have no empathy, no sympathy, no understanding for what that person is going through. You know, so I'm appreciative of that. But also, I can also be demanding because I've been there and I know what that looks like. So you have both spectrums. You know, so I love that. And you can tell people, hey, man, I've been there and I'm living proof of, if you continue to work and you attack this as if you're getting paid, you know, $200,000 a year, eventually that'll come. You know, so that's the part of, you know, really starting at rock bottom and fighting for every inch that I really love, appreciate, and, you know, can understand as I see other guys go through that journey.
What was your favorite part of coaching that first year? Was there some aspect of it that stood out to you? You're like, yeah, this is what I love. Was it the recruiting? Was it on the floor coaching? Was it something else? What was it that first year that really leaped out at you? You're like, man, I love this.
Well, I was very spoiled. You know, we won the league with 4.5 scholarships, and it had never been done in the history of that program. So I love being
love winning, right? You love winning
on a team that won.
Nice,
you know.
Nice.
So I was spoiled right out of the gate to have that experience. But no, I think, you know, for me, you know, it's one thing to become a coach; it's another thing to coach guys you just played with. You know, so learning how to navigate that and being able to coach them and hold them accountable and having their respect, you know, where things weren't awkward. That was a great transition for me. You know, that was a great teacher for me, you know. So that part was awesome, to be able to coach guys that you just played with and they, you know, respect you enough to listen and follow through on something. You know, that was an awesome part of that experience.
So after you leave Bemidji, you have a series of different jobs as an assistant at a bunch of different universities, different levels, different locations around the country. So maybe just hit for us some of the things that you learned on your journey as an assistant coach that eventually here, as you get your first opportunity at Loyola Marymount, what are some of the things that you learned along the way as an assistant that you feel are going to help you to be successful in your first stint as a head coach?
Well, I think, you know, I've been so privileged. I've worked with so many good coaches. You know, I think about Herb Sendek and our time at Arizona State, Jim Boylan, who was just the former coach of the Chicago Bulls when him and I was together at Utah. You know, going to a place like Marquette and seeing how they treat basketball and how it's done at an elite level. Being at Drake with Mark Phelps, working for Bobby Braswell at Cal State Northridge, who was the longest tenured African-American coach for the longest time in college basketball. You know, I've seen every facet. And the one thing that I know is you have to continue to evolve as a person. You have to continue to evolve as a coach. And the best coaches never make it about them. It's always about the players. It's always about making sure that these guys accomplish the things that they're dreaming about. And if your eye and your heart is on that target, things will happen for you. You know, we're not here to serve, these kids aren't here to serve us. We're here to serve them. And in serving them, holding them accountable, developing them, helping them grow, there is no greater joy than that. To seeing kids, you know, reach things they probably never even imagined or dreamt was possible. And for me, that's done through a relationship. And I'm a big believer in that. You have to have a strong relationship in order to have success. And the relationships you have with your players are vital. And those kids need to feel like I'm playing for somebody, I'm being recruited by somebody who truly cares about me and who truly loves me. And in all my stops along the way, I can honestly tell you the people who have done that the best have had the best outcomes. And if you have if I have 15 minutes in a day and I have the decision to make whether to watch a little more film or spend that time with a player, you spend that time with a player. You know, so that would be one thing. The other thing I've learned is as you progress, especially as an assistant coach, it's okay to be happy for other guys' success. Someone getting to some place sooner than you does not mean that your opportunity is not coming. And I think sometimes in this business, we spend so much time being so competitive, which I love and I get, especially in recruiting, that we will negatively recruit against somebody to get a player. And I always say, you know what? That player, if we're fortunate enough, will be in your program for 4 to 5 years. But your career is way longer than that. And the same guy that you negatively recruited against someday may be in a position to help you. Don't be short-sighted. I tell our staff that all the time here. We're going to sell us.
because what we have to sell is good enough. You know, I, that would be, you know, advice I would give everybody. Sell you. Make it about you. Don't go negative. Tell facts. If you want to, if you want to sell data, how we style a play, all that, do that. But make sure you're doing it the right way. Make sure you're being classy, because this is a, such a small business. And I'm telling you, man, it's very circular. You know, so that would be the second thing. The third thing I would say is, and I kind of said it about making the big time where you are, be happy with where you're at. You know, don't be a job hunter, a job seeker. Where you're at, be present. Do the best job you can. And in due time, opportunity will find you. When it's time to go out and advance yourself and make yourself better, do that. But be present, focus on you, work hard, and don't compare your journey to anyone else. I tell people all the time, comparison is the thief of joy. And there's 300 in some of these jobs. They're hard to get. If you're in the business, you're very fortunate. So don't take that for granted. But those are the things that I carry with me into this seat. Is it's always about the players, period. What's most important is what we're doing, not what other people are doing. We take the high road and we're always classy in how we do our business. Those things will come back to you. So that's, in a nutshell, you know, what I've taken away from my journey and the places I've been. The other thing I'll add to that real quick is, you know, support your teammates. You know, the coaches that you work with as an assistant coach, sell those guys. Get along. You know, it doesn't have to be you getting something right. It has to be us getting it right. You know, put your ego aside. Nothing has hurt more companies and more teams and more programs than our ego, because our ego gets in the way. If we win, everybody wins. You know, so that would be kind of what I've taken, you know, from my journey.
So I think the overriding theme through all of those is something that you've talked about, not just when you were discussing that question, but also that you've mentioned before, and that's the relationships and how the connection with people, whether it be your fellow coaches on your staff, whether it be your players, whether it be on the recruiting trail when you're working with players and their families, those relationships are so important. So when you look at how you're going to develop relationships as a head coach, and obviously you've been put into a position with the pandemic that it's not a normal situation in terms of how you probably would have built relationships with your players had you been hired in March of 2019 instead of March of 2020. But just as you envision what building relationships with your players looks like, talk about what you've done to this point, what that looks like on the ground right now, and then moving forward, providing that at some point we return to normalcy, what does that look like day in, day out in the practice floor, you know, on campus? What does it look like when you're interacting with your players, building those relationships that are so important to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'll say this about the pandemic. In a lot of ways, it's helped. You know, usually when you get a job, you're off and running, man. You hit the ground, you're recruiting, you're doing this, you're at this spot, you're getting pulled in so many different directions. And for a while, you know, things have slowed down. So, you know, I hadn't met all my team physically until about 3 weeks ago. There was about seven guys I haven't met. There's still one coming in that I have not met physically. But I talked to my guys every other day when I took the job on the phone. And we Zoomed as a team, like every Thursday we had a Zoom. And, you know, we were very intentional about what we were doing. And the first thing I wanted them to know is, I'm going to care about you. And how do I care about you? Well, as a player, you know, we broke down.
who they were as a person, who they were as a player, who they were as a student. And we gave them the areas that they had to get better at. And we talked about that. You know, now that we're not only that, I got to know their parents. You know, spending time with their parents on the phone, Zooming all their parents. You know, the connection piece is important. You know, there's three things in my program that my three core principles. One is we're going to be selfless. And for us, that means LM over you. Two is connected. And that's what you and I are talking about right now. That means relationships before championships. And the third is relentless, and we attack everything. So, you know, the connection piece, there's nothing bigger than that. Now that we're in person, we meet. Obviously, we social distance. It's outside. We have a meeting space. We meet every Wednesday as a team. And we call those culture meetings. So, for example, we're going through the six C's of leadership. And today was the first day of that. And today we met about communication. You know, we spent an hour on what communication looks like in our program, from player to player, from coach to player, from coach to coach. You know, every week I have an individual meeting with every member of my team. You know, where I schedule out 30 minutes for each guy, where we spend one-on-one time. You know, as things hopefully begin to open up, you know, I envision us going to lunch, having a guy to my house for dinner. Like, I want them to know my kids, my family. I want them to see that side. You know, I tell kids all the time, like, we should have a kind of relationship where if you called me on a Friday night and said, "Hey, coach, I'm bored, I'm hungry," I'd say, "Hey, come over, Eli. You could come over. You can open my fridge. You can pour yourself a lemonade, get yourself something to eat, fall asleep on the couch, and never have to ask if that's okay." I want that to feel like home. Because if we have that relationship, when we get on the court, now I say, "Hey, you got to do A, B, and C." You may not like A, B, and C, but you're going to say, "You know what? I know Coach Stan truly loves me. And I know it's coming from a good place. Therefore, I'm going to do it." So, you know, for me, man, I believe you have to love tough before you can show tough love. That's just the society we're in. And I think the days, you know, especially a guy like me, when you're a no name and you haven't done anything, right? You know, you're not just going to come in and "We're doing this, we're doing that." You have to gain trust. You have to gain these kids' trust. It's different. You got to coach them a little different. But once they believe in you, once they know that you care about them and you love them, now you have permission to be honest. So for me, that's what that looks like. And that's how we want to build that here with our guys. And I think sometimes when people hear about love and relationships, "Oh, look at that. That's all fairy dust stuff. That's soft." Nah, that's hard. That's hard. Being vulnerable is hard. And to me, that sticks, that lasts. And it takes a lot of work to do it. And you've got to be really vulnerable to do it. And that's how we connect. That's how I see us building this relationship.
Yeah, I think what you said there about being able to put your ego aside and earn the trust of your players, that's something that if I think about situations where I've been in as a player or that I've been in as a coach, I think it's so critically important that your players believe in you and trust that you have their best interest at heart. And when that is the case, then I think you get more out of your team. And I think especially in today's world with players and kids the way they are and the way that they've evolved over time, to me, I don't think you can really be successful without that connection piece that you just so eloquently described. So you mentioned your six C's. Just for coaches out there who are curious what those six C's are, you mentioned the first one was communication. I could probably guess a couple, but I'm going to let you just go ahead and run off those six for us.
Yeah, so, you know, right now we're in a leadership series with our team, and I call it the six C's of leadership. And for example, today we went over communication. That was our first C, but those six are communication, connection, character, you know, consistency in terms of who you are, competence and courage. You know, those are the six C's. And obviously, those are the things I want our guys to embody here. You know, what is striking to me, I think, and something that's really stood out everywhere I've been, you hear people talk about leadership a lot. And there's a lot of kids who've never led. They've never been in those positions. They don't understand it. And sometimes we have to teach them what leadership looks like in order for them to lead. And you have to spend time doing that. And that's a big part of our culture. So over the next 6 weeks, you know, we're going to take one of those C's and really break that down. For example, today I gave our guys a sheet and it had our staff's name on it as well. Everybody had their own sheet. You started with your own sheet, a piece of paper that had Stan Johnson, and you would then pass it to the guy to your right. And everybody had to write what they or how they felt that person was communicating in the program and what they could do to improve. You know, so again, it gave us inside information on what we think of each other. But we were also able to establish today how we communicate within the LMU program. You know, in the next meeting next week will be about, you know, connection and how we connect. You know, so that's how we're trying to build leadership and culture within what we're doing.
And I think that's so important that you break it down for your players that they can actually see and have you teach them what communication looks like, what character looks like, what connection looks like. Because so often we hear coaches say that this word or that word are the pillars of their program, and then the players can repeat what those words are, but they don't necessarily know what behaviors are associated with those words. And to me, that's so important as a leader when you're trying to develop leaders and develop your kids and develop your team, is to give them things that they can actually do to demonstrate those things. And then, of course, we know just like you would coach a kid out on the floor in terms of their basketball skill, you want to notice and praise and reward those kids when they're doing the things that you want them to do for those culture building things that you were just describing as part of your six C's.
Yeah. You know, I told them today, you know, one of the things they had to do after they all got we all got our paper back, we had a chance to look at it. We had to now come up with an action step on what we were going to do to improve based on the feedback we got. You know, so now everybody heard what each member of the team is going to do. Now we have a chance to hold them accountable to that. You know, so those are things that, you know, you can hang your hat on and you can measure. So that's how we're trying to build culture, build leadership, but also have accountability behind it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Like I said, I just think that when you give something to kids that they can hold on to, something concrete, it makes it a lot more real for them. And I think it makes it a lot easier for you to get what you're looking for as a coach, as opposed to just a nebulous buzzword that the kids can repeat it, but they can't necessarily act on it. And I love the fact that you're giving them the tools that they need to be able to act on those things. I want to be respectful of your time and wrap up here with one final two-part question for you. And the first part is, when you look ahead from where we are today at the beginning of September at Loyola Marymount University, and you think about what you need to do to get that program where you want it to be, what is your biggest challenge that you see moving forward? And then number two, what is your biggest joy? When you get out of the bed in the morning, what is the one thing that puts a smile on your face when you think, man, I cannot wait to get into work today? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
Yeah. You know, I think the biggest challenge for me is, I'm always very careful how I say this, because I have the utmost respect for coaches. I do. I'm a coach's guy. I'm a defender of coaches. And I think sometimes, you know, when you take a job over, there's a tendency to there's a tendency to use this, change the culture. We got to change the culture. And I think that's so disrespectful to the people that came in front of you. I'm very appreciative of the people who have come in front of me. And not only Coach Dunlap, who was just currently here, but Max Good and everybody before Max that had this job. They've all put me in a position to be successful. So it's not, we got to change the culture. For me, we have to grow our culture. And that's the biggest challenge. We have to grow a culture that our guys fight for every single day. And we have to grow a culture not only within our team, but within our athletic department, within our university, of this expectation to be good. We can be good. We can be great here. But here's how we go about it. And here are the standards. And you're either above the line or you're below the line, period. Because what it takes to be great, you cannot negotiate with at any level. So that's my biggest challenge, is getting our team to understand that, what it truly takes, that good is not good enough if better is possible. And, you know, from our department and our university to all lock arms and be all in on getting this thing to the level it needs to be at. And I'm very fortunate to work with a president who's committed to that. And I'm very fortunate to work with an athletic director that's committed to that. You know, so I think we have alignment and we have three people locked arm in arm in trying to create that growth within our program. The thing that excites me most about getting up and getting to work is I'm working at Loyola Marymount. And I'm telling you, this is as beautiful of a place as I've been to. I mean, it's incredible. And I see tremendous opportunity here, even in a pandemic. And it's not like, you know, when I was thinking about becoming a head coach, the one thing I always said is, you know, you want to be a head coach for a long time. You've got to, these jobs are hard to get, but you also have to make sure you take the right one. There's no doubt in my mind I took the right one. And our name here, the Loyola Marymount name, still carries weight, and it still has a national presence based on what happened 30 years ago. And what excites me the most is that when we get this back to where it's supposed to be, it's going to be one of the great stories in college basketball. So that excites me, the fact that I get to have a chance to make a change there, a chance to wake up every day and work on this beautiful campus with, like I said, the athletic director that I work with and the president that I work with. Those things, you know, bring a smile to my face.
Yeah, absolutely. Having all that in alignment is critical, I think, to any coach's success. And I think you could talk to college coaches about that, and you could certainly talk to high school coaches about it. You could probably talk to NBA and pro coaches about that. When everybody's in line, it makes it a lot easier for the coach to do what needs to be done. Before we wrap up, Stan, I want to give you a chance to promote your program, share where people can connect with the Loyola Marymount Lions, where they can connect with you, whether that's social media, website. Just tell us the best way to get in touch with you, follow your program, so that people can keep their eye on what you're doing there and what you're building.
Yeah, our program, I hope people will follow us, people who are listening, follow this journey as we continue to grow this program and become competitive and consistent. Our website on Twitter and on Instagram is LMU Lions, LIONS. And my Twitter handle is at LMU Coach Johnson. So you can find me on Twitter there, and you can find us on Instagram and on Twitter at LMU Lions. So again, I'm excited to be the coach here. I'm excited to lead this program. You know, who would have thought I would have had my first job during a pandemic where it's already hard enough to be a head coach?
Absolutely.
But there's no blueprint for this, but I've really, and we have really found opportunity in that. So I hope people will join us and follow us as we go.
Absolutely. I can say that we will definitely be keeping an eye on your progress and following what you're doing and what you're building out there. We cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to join us tonight and spend an hour of your time talking hoops with us and sharing your journey, giving some great pieces of advice to coaches out there who are at various stages of their journey. And just want to say to you, congratulations on the opportunity to be a head coach for the first time. And based on the conversation that we had tonight and the way that you're going to go about building things, I have no doubt that you're going to be a tremendous success, and we're going to follow you every step of the way. Cannot thank you enough for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it. And to everyone who's out there listening, we appreciate it. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.